Today in Studio 360, we like to watch.
I watch hundreds of silent, live-streaming TV cameras around the world. Sometimes I watch delivery men stop by a pub in England. And there's a chef in Tokyo who smiles when he cuts sushi.
Surveillance technology is now available to everybody. Or we can watch the watchers. The artist Trevor Paglen watches the government snooping on us from outer space.
How do you know it's spy satellites?
Because I track all the spy satellites with this software that's open on the computer in front of you.
And with the technology of the WikiLeaks age, the old exclusively top-down power of surveillance gets turned on its head.
It's not as if we should be scared of Big Brother. Big Brother should be scared of all of us. So the fact that citizens are in a better position to watch their government is a good thing.
Tapping into the culture of surveillance, that's ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Wynton Marsalis at 50, a jazz celebration for the ages, on October 13th at 8. The broadcast will also be streamed on PBS.org. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. And by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In my lifetime, I don't expect to see another design visionary as important as Steve Jobs. Through Apple, for all these years, he, more than anybody else, made us like computers, even love them. I'm as much an Apple cultist as anybody I know, and at studio360.org, I've posted an appreciation for Jobs and his impact on my life. Today's show is all about technology and how comfortable we've gotten with it. Maybe too comfortable. For our series on science and creativity, this week we're looking at surveillance. Even the word sounds Cold War. Phone taps and hidden microphones, guys sitting in vans with tape recorders and telephoto lenses. But computers have made surveillance part of everyone's everyday life. These days, we're all targets.
Pay attention.
And happily complicit in our own targeting. There are so many cameras installed now on street corners, in malls, gas stations, ATMs. You can be photographed hundreds of times over the course of a single day. And Studio 360's Eric Malinsky thinks that's kind of great.
It's 8 o'clock in the morning in Moscow. At this really sleek modern hotel, these two cleaning ladies are staring at something they don't like above the front door. And they keep poking at it with their mops, and these businessmen are walking by. It's really funny. I'm watching them, but I'm not in Moscow. I'm lying in bed in Brooklyn. When I can't sleep, I watch hundreds of silent, live-streaming, closed-circuit TV cameras around the world on my iPhone. I'm using this app called iSpy. You can download it for 99 cents. The cameras appear in a checkerboard layout, kind of like the opening credits of the Brady Bunch. And when I select a window by tapping on it, that video fills up the whole screen. They're all public access cameras, and I can move some of them around in the real world by swiping my finger on the iPhone. Now, at this time of night, most of the cameras in the United States are dark, but a lot of them are just college campuses anyway. I like to watch the global cameras. There's a mountain village in Austria that's so precious. I like to imagine chocolate inside every building. I like to watch the sunrise over a quiet harbor in Norway. I can see the morning mist on a swimming pool in Italy. Sometimes I watch delivery men stop by a pub in England. And there's a chef in Tokyo who smiles when he cuts sushi. My fiance, who is halfway asleep at this point, will ask me, "Are you doing your voyeurism thing again?" It's a little creepy, I'll admit it. I mean, the cleaning ladies in Moscow have no idea that I'm watching them. I think the sushi chef, though, in Japan knows. But I'm not the only one. I mean, iSpy has been a top-selling app in Japan, Sweden, Italy, Australia, Ireland, and the UK. I find it comforting. I've had insomnia since I was a kid. Back then, my favorite book was Goodnight Moon. And weirdly for me, iSpy is like this high-tech global surveillance version of that book. Good night, Russian concierge. Good night, Melbourne Ski Lodge. Good night, Norwegian Bay. Good night, bar in Taipei. Good night, Estonia. Good night, Bologna. Good night, people everywhere.
It sounds like you were amused rather than freaked out. That cackle you hear is Jaron Lanier, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Jaron is here with me in Studio 360. He is a technologist and a thinker and writer. His latest book is called You Are Not a Gadget.
The thing that kind of worries me is when people think they're seeing more of the world than they really are. And I can give you a great example of that. The financial crisis was kind of brought on by people thinking they were global voyeurs and assuming a kind of omniscience that they didn't have. And of course, all they did is they turned themselves into idiots because it wasn't true. And so, you know, I mean, the thing about information is always that it can kind of hypnotize you. It can make you think you're wise when you aren't. And as long as you have a dose of self-skepticism and a dollop of empathy and, you know, a sense of ethics, I think making the world more transparent can be a great thing. But the illusions that it can bring about can really be quite dangerous.
So I was recently rereading 1984 and was, on the one hand, struck by how many things it got right. But on the other, this basic converse of that is that instead of Big Brother watching us, we have all signed up voluntarily to have little brothers and sort of outsourced the totalitarianism and made it DIY and voluntary.
Well, look, there's two issues with privacy that really matter. What doesn't matter is just this feeling of whether you're bashful or not, or some sort of, you know, like the aesthetic sensibility of whether you care what people know about you and all that is not the most important thing. The two things that matter are, first of all, differentials in information access. So if somebody else knows more about you than you know about them, then that creates a power difference. And so all the wealth and clout has been going to the people who are close to the big spy computers, whether it's Wall Street hedge funds or Silicon Valley advertising exchanges. You know, and this idea that just being close to one of the big computers that collects all the data is what gives you power is not a formula for long-time success of a civilization, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue with what we call privacy is just self-invention. Because if you have radical anti-anonymity, which happens on Facebook, where you're forced to have right. only one persona, you also have dysfunction that comes about where people can become pretty mean and clickish on Facebook too. And I think what radical anti-anonymity and radical anonymity have in common is that people don't get to choose. I mean, the truth is that being a person involves finding some kind of balance where you reveal yourself to a degree, but you also, there might be a bit of mystery involved because you're sort of always inventing yourself and there's a bit of ambiguity. And if you were to outlaw anonymity completely, you'd kill a whole lot of culture and personality development. I mean, you wouldn't have Bob Dylan, for instance, because you'd still see his Facebook page from when he was Zimmerman from Minnesota. You'd just kill it. You'd kill the romance.
That's computer pioneer and author Jaron Lanier. He'll be joining me again later in the show.
John is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat badge out laid off says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off.
Coming up, you're being photographed and videoed everywhere all the time, but nobody's really watching that, right? Nobody can recognize you. The machines can.
Hey, laser lips. Your mama was a snowblower.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion. What moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're talking about surveillance. There are thousands and thousands of closed-circuit surveillance cameras in New York City. At least one of them belongs to an artist.
Our image is being taken probably hundreds of times a day.
That's Wafa Bilal. Last year, he installed a tiny camera in the back of his head. He surgically embedded it.
By having the camera very visible, implanted in my head, this project is really raising awareness about surveillance.
Since then, for almost 300 days now, once a minute, his camera has automatically snapped pictures of what's ever behind him. Those pictures are then streamed live over his website, which we've got a link to at studio360.org. It sounds like a zany art project now, but what Bilal's doing might, in a few years, be as normal as posting a status update on Facebook. The government isn't installing cameras in the backs of people's heads yet, but it's seriously investing in technology that tracks and identifies people. A lot of that research is in the field of facial recognition and teaching a machine to recognize a face in any environment at any angle. Turns out to be a very tricky task.
One of the big shifts in the field over the course of the last 5 years is to do what we call face recognition in the wild, which is essentially how can you do it given that the subject is not necessarily cooperating. They're being photographed in the course of doing something like, mm-hmm. Walking through a door.
Peter Bellhumer is a professor of computer science at Columbia University. Over the last 15 years, he's been one of the leaders in the quest to give computers the ability to recognize human faces. What's the wildest circumstance, the least controlled circumstance under which it works reliably, and what is beyond its current ability to work?
Well, that's an excellent question, but it depends on the application. So if you want to put a face recognition system on a personal computer to prevent access by people who shouldn't be on it, the systems work fine for that, right? That's not a problem. If you have a photo that's taken of someone, with a subway camera, with poor quality, they're looking down, and you want to recognize that person in a data set, say, of a million photos, we're not there yet.
So what is the science? How does this work?
When you start with an image, you essentially have a sensor which measures, photon counts at each pixel. And so that measurement, we like to say, is very high dimensional. And so the question is, how do you take this high dimensional measurement, extract features from it which are discriminative, that allow you to tell one thing from another? And so one of the things that we were looking at doing was to figure out, why is it that it's so hard to do recognition in the wild, with images where there's so much variability? And we'd been doing a lot of work in species identification, in particular with plants. And so in that world, the game is essentially, in taxonomy, is to recognize something using what's known as a dichotomous key. You ask a series of questions about the visual appearance, and when you answer those questions, you follow a tree, and at the bottom of the tree is the species. In a case of a leaf, is it simple or compound? Is its margin toothed or not?
The kinds
and so
of stuff
on.
You do one does in science classes.
Exactly. But you'd answer those questions. That's taxonomy. And so
right.
We thought, maybe there's an analogy in the work that we're doing in the face space. Is it possible that we can look at images of faces and also describe them in that fashion? So what's the age? What's the ethnicity? What's the gender? Do they have thick eyebrows or not? What's the eye color? And so on. So here's an example of that.
We're looking at a big computer screen of a lot of faces.
So if you have these, there are many different faces, and if you just look at females and those wearing eyeglasses that are middle-aged with dark hair, you can winnow this collection of many photos to just down to one. And you don't have to do it that way. You could do it a different way. For instance, Caucasians with teeth showing, outside, with a tilted head.
Uh-huh. Right?
And you would arrive at a different person. So we call these different questions describable visual attributes. And so what we spend a lot of time doing is building classifiers that are very good at doing this in images.
You get government funding in part?
Yes.
From DARPA or one of those?
We just say Department of Defense.
Uh-huh.
And you can imagine why that sort of thing is important to them.
Right. So especially in war, as we have come to know it, in counterinsurgency situations and all that.
That's right. And one of the reasons that face recognition doesn't go away is because it's essentially this passive biometric, and you can acquire the data at a distance.
Does the ultimate application of this, the ways in which it could be used, ever give you pause?
Well, we think about it a lot, certainly within the group, and I don't think we're at the point at which these sorts of biometrics can essentially label people with perfect identity or any of that. And I think that there are interesting policy questions about, that surround that. And, personally, I'm on the side of less of this is better. But I think it's a really interesting scientific question.
Will you reach a point, though, as this gets better and better and better in your research, some years hence, where your predisposition to think that less is more comes to a head with, look how good we've gotten?
Yeah, I think at that point I'll stop. But but there's no danger of that yet.
Really?
Yeah.
You've still got another 10 years of making it better?
There's a lot of work to do. And I think that, you know, when you get better in one domain, then people ask you to solve it for another. And so that's where we are now.
The Columbia University professor Peter Bellhumer. Facial recognition isn't his only game. He's just developed a really nifty iPhone app for identifying trees from their leaves. You can hear more about that at studio360.org. So we know the government sometimes likes to watch us, but an artist named Trevor Paglen has decided to watch the government. For one project, he's made hundreds of photographs of spy satellites as they cross the sky. Lisa Katayama followed Paglen up to the roof of his loft across the bay from San Francisco.
I'm on a rooftop in West Oakland with Trevor Paglen. I'm here because Paglen insists that in a few minutes, we will be photographing a secret spy satellite called La Crosse 5 that's passing through the night sky. I never really thought of stargazing as a fine art, but I'm willing to check it out, even though it's pretty freaking cold and windy up here on the roof.
Yeah, this is going to be really... it's really bad conditions.
Paglen is obsessed with the CIA. He also has a PhD in geography, and he calls the art he makes experimental geography. His projects can get really elaborate. He goes on long field trips to the desert to visit places that the government makes sure are never shown on Google Earth, like cell phone towers where the feds listen in on people's conversations.
I bet that's the International Space Station right there.
How do you know?
Because it's not an airplane, and the International Space Station is the brightest satellite by far. It looks like that.
Trevor is first and foremost a photographer, but he spends at least half his time online, talking to guys in chat rooms, combing through government documents, and sorting through data sets. It's a lot of research. It wasn't until after 9/11 that he really started to get interested in this.
What was very clear to me from September 12th was that the administration was going to use that event to do all sorts of really historically unprecedented things in terms of transforming the structure of the state. So those are the kind of political reasons that I was interested in secrecy or am interested in secrecy. But in the visual art, it's more about how do we know what we know? And how do we come to terms with a landscape that is constructed in such a way as to be invisible to us?
He became obsessed with spy satellites after he tapped into an obscure group of hobbyists on the internet called plane spotters.
These are guys that just kind of hang around airports and write down tail numbers of airplanes that land. A lot of these guys would upload their records to the internet and inadvertently ended up creating these searchable databases that you could use as a part of this tracking of these CIA planes. And I came across some other guys who were doing satellite spotting, tracking secret satellites, and I just thought, that's amazing. I'm going to have to come back to that someday.
Which is exactly what Paglen did. Here's how it works. The FAA keeps a record of all planes and satellites sent into space. And
the U.S. Strategic Command publishes a catalog of everything that they track in space. And they track commercial satellites, they track military satellites from other countries.
So by process of elimination, Paglen can figure out what's been sent out into space, but is not being tracked. Trevor has the precise coordinates and timing of La Crosse 5 all figured out. At 7:48 p.m. and 37 seconds, it will show up two-thirds of the way down the horizon from the North Star and move westward.
I've got the camera set up to do a 30-second exposure, but there's so much light pollution that I'm actually going to pull off on that because I think that'll just blow out.
As Trevor and I stand on his rooftop with two cameras, a laser pointer, and an atomic clock on his iPhone, the gravity of our experiment suddenly hits home for me. We're about to witness a spy satellite flying right over San Francisco.
You just kind of look at the stars and then you kind of just like almost like relax your eyes and then your eyes will be drawn to anything that moves. That might be it right there. Right there. You see it?
Kind of.
Do you see the laser pointer?
Oh, yeah, I see it. It's so hard to see. You wouldn't see it if you didn't know it was there.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like you gotta know kind of exactly what you're looking for. But yeah, it's like a little faint star kind of moving across the sky pretty slowly.
That's a spy satellite.
Yeah. Maybe it's taking a picture of you.
And maybe it is. We'll never know. But we got a picture of it. The photo itself is kind of anticlimactic. It's like a blank canvas painted a deep purple with tiny little specks of stars. And if you look really carefully, right below the center, you can see a faint streak of white where the La Crosse 5 made its way across the sky. Without knowing the story behind it, it might not seem like art, but I think I get it now.
Part of your job as an artist is to try to see things that other people don't see. And through the rigor that I bring to the research, I try to get to a point where I can see something maybe that other people haven't seen that is poignant and that is worth pointing out.
You just must be a really curious person.
Yes. Or obsessive compulsive, you know, take your pick.
For Studio 360, I'm Lisa Katayama.
You can see one of Trevor Paglen's spy satellite photographs at studio360.org, and more of his work is now on exhibit in a photography show at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking with the digital philosopher Jaron Lanier about the culture of surveillance. So, Jaron, what did you think of that? I find myself happy that he's regarding what he does as art rather than thinking it gives him control over the degree to which he's spied upon.
Well, you know, there's this sense that, oh, now everyday people can share data about spy satellites to know where they are, which presumably the foreign governments who might be interested in American spy satellites already know where they are. I mean, what I would ask Trevor is he aware of how much Google or Facebook has collected information about him? You know, I think that we're missing the big picture often. We get lost in these little dramas of various activists, the WikiLeakers or whatever, being sort of mini spies, and we're missing the overall way that we're creating a whole world of commerce based on spying on ourselves.
So essentially we have the commercial culture and Silicon Valley creating what you've called this castle of secrecy by spying on us. And then you have the government. Of those two choices, of those two castles of secrecy, which one concerns you more?
Well, the commercial one concerns me more because the government actually has a way to use spying that makes sense in the event that it helps fight a war. Whether it makes itself incompetent or not, of course, becomes the big question. And I hope it doesn't become less competent than the people who are trying to destroy America, let's say. But the world of commerce, in a way, scares me more because this giant memory capacity on the internet has allowed us to lie to ourselves more efficiently than ever before. Mm-hmm. We can create this illusion that these giant financial transactions actually make sense when they don't, just because all the bits are there and they seem to be their own reality. And in the same way, we can make this illusion that we have a productive economy when it's really only based on advertising and spying and there's no substance at the core, or it's deteriorating. And if we miss the big picture because we're so hypnotized by the bits we've laid down in our computers, that scares me more than what the government might do, actually.
I get the Soviet Union should have had a slogan, don't be evil, and everybody would have bought into it, I guess.
Well, you know, I sometimes make the joke that in the Soviet Union and in many other systems, people trust government to do the spying, but here we want free enterprise to spy on us.
The movie Minority Report, which was based on a Philip K. Dick story, you were a creative consultant on that movie. And I remember one of the scenes that people still mention from the film was where Tom Cruise goes into a mall and the advertisements are aimed at him as he passes the products. Let's listen to a clip from that film.
A road diverges in the desert. Lexus. The road you're on, John Anderton, no is the one less traveled.
Good evening, John.
You can move the old-fashioned
John Anderton. Every 21
miles provides gourmet cuisine.
John Anderton, you can use a Guinness right about now.
Stress out, John Anderton.
Is it fun at all, Harrison? Get away, John Anderton. Forget your troubles.
That was Minority Report from almost a decade ago. Was that your idea?
Yeah, that one actually was based on a working technology. I actually made something approximately like that and brought it into a script meeting. And and there it is on the screen. Yeah. One of the things about Minority Report is it was supposed to be a dystopian world. So all the gadgets in it are sort of negative. They don't quite work. But that particular one where you're scooped up into the advertisement was actually a working prototype from a little company called iMatic that Google eventually bought. But, you know, the funny thing about it is that in Silicon Valley, a lot of people, I think, are attracted to that particular kind of darkness. There's a way in which that world is one that empowers the nerdiest, the best hackers are the ones who are the most powerful, you know, and it attracts a lot of young technical men in particular. There's sort of like this hyper-empowered Asperger's-like feeling about it. Like, you know, if I can hack, I'll be all-powerful. And you get that feeling a lot in some of the big Silicon Valley companies and in Facebook and whatnot. And you get it in the WikiLeaks culture. And I am part of that world, and I just want to try to get my fellow nerds to see how short-sighted it is.
Jaron Lanier, thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist, philosopher, and you can learn more about his work at studio360.org. His latest book is called You Are Not a Gadget. Coming up, cookies. Cute, sweet, special treats, right? Nope. Invisible and ubiquitous surveillance software.
The cookie is made to seem sinister because it sounds mysterious. It's a little line of data that says this browser went to this page. That's it.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson, and I am being watched right now. Every move I make, tracked, my preferences recorded. What am I doing? I'm doing what I do every day, Googling different subjects, buying things, visiting websites. Nothing much to be ashamed of, but do I really want people knowing every move I make online? Not quite a year ago, the Federal Trade Commission proposed a do not track list so we could click and sign up for greater anonymity to hide from online marketers where we go and what we do. The technology that makes all this digital eavesdropping possible? Cookies. Studio 360's Derek John explains.
Here's all you really need to know about cookies. Without them, the World Wide Web as we know it would cease to exist. Really.
I would say cookies are by far the most controversial and misunderstood thing that I've ever invented.
And this coming from the guy who invented the blink tag. Lou Montoli is his name, and yes, I know where he lives.
I've gotten people telling me the most outrageous things that they thought cookies were responsible for, you know, creating viruses and destroying their PC, and they can blame anything that went wrong in their life on cookies.
Cookies trace their origins to 1994. Lou was a founding engineer at Netscape then, working on the first commercial web browser. This is back when Amazon was just a rainforest, and shopping online meant a long wait at the supermarket.
I remember going to a meeting specifically discussing the shopping cart problem.
The problem was that your virtual shopping cart had no way of remembering what you had added to it.
The technology was such that each time you contacted a website and moved from page to page, essentially the server would forget everything about you.
Some engineers proposed assigning a unique identifier to your personal browser so that companies could keep track of you when you went online. But that also meant that companies could keep track of you when you went online. Lou had a better idea.
Maybe we just use this concept from Unix systems programming called the magic cookie, which allowed you to hold a piece of data privately and just return it on a regular basis.
His big invention was just a few kilobytes of random text stored on your computer. It's why websites can remember your password. That is, unless you delete your cookies, which you can also do.
So the concept of cookies came up as something that was supposed to just be a contract between you and a single website and something that you could actually control.
But by the early millennium, even the father of the cookie had lost control. Lou remembers being caught off guard one night while surfing the web.
I went to a website and I was looking for something reasonably unique, I think maybe a pair of ice skates.
Lou kept browsing. He was on another website when suddenly an ad for ice skates popped up.
And I thought to myself, yeah, that's a big coincidence. And then I go to another website and another advertisement, the same advertisement for ice skates comes up. And I start thinking to myself, well, that's way too much of a coincidence.
Lou had stumbled onto a new lucrative use for his invention, targeted advertising. And that's why Jeff Jarvis says cookies are the best thing since, well, you know, that other food.
The cookie is made to seem sinister because it sounds mysterious. It's a little line of data that says this browser went to this page. That's it.
Jarvis is a popular tech blogger and author of What Would Google Do?
The holy grail of Google is to intuit our intent. To figure out what you want even before you want it. And isn't this the coolest thing on earth when you start typing in Google and you make a mistake and it says, did you mean? How did it know that? Right? That's really cool. That's not creepy. That's okay. That was helping us.
You can call it paranoia. I think it's a justifiable fear.
Helen Niesenbaum is a privacy expert at New York University. She thinks companies are increasingly poking their noses where they don't belong.
I mean, what is it about a totalitarian government that's problematic? They know everything about you, and they're there in every part of your life. So it's not a matter of sharing information. It's who you're going to share it with. Can you trust them? Can they manipulate you in ways that you are concerned about? And that's my fear.
But Jeff Jarvis says we've been here before.
The first serious discussion of a legal right to privacy in the United States occurred in 1890. And it was because of the invention of the Kodak camera. Because the camera tied to the penny press allowed someone to take a picture of you anywhere and print it for everyone. And they looked at that and they said, that's scary. That's creepy.
Still, the proliferation of so-called third-party cookies mean ad networks can follow our clicks across an ever larger swath of the internet. Just how large? Helen Niesenbaum isn't waiting to find out.
I now have Track Me Not listed under my tools.
She and her team at NYU recently designed a browser extension called Track Me Not. I dropped by her office to see how it works.
So what you see now are searches that Track Me Not is doing.
Working in the background, Track Me Not continuously sends random text queries to search engines.
We download a bunch of fake query terms.
The idea is to fog up the mirror, so to speak.
Right now it's going to AOL search engine, Bing search engine, Yahoo search engine.
So Track Me Not is essentially fighting cookies with cookies. Jeff Jarvis thinks that kind of defeats the purpose.
If we didn't have targeting technology in the internet, what you would have is, number one, a bunch of dancing monkey ads, those horrible ads, the cheapest, most awful ads, because there's no way to know anything about you and target the advertising. You would also have a hell of a lot less content. So cookies are good. Cookies are your friend.
At least that's what companies like Google would have us believe.
At Google, we make privacy a priority in everything we do.
The search engine giant now lets users opt out of certain profiling categories. And if you know where to look, you can even see your own personal cookie. Google keeps it on file.
ID equals 800001D560EF644190/480728.
I guess that's reassuring. But what about Lou Montoli, the man who wreaked this havoc in the first place? He says without cookies, there are far sneakier tracking devices out there to pry into our digital secrets.
If cookies aren't here and if we don't have the protections of cookies, there's going to be something way worse down the pike, and I'm a little bit scared to find out what that would be.
And besides, a lot of us already give up that information to social networks anyway.
If cookies are cookies, then Facebook is more like a double Big Mac. you know what we need as the analogy? We need, who was it in Ghostbusters that said it?
According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie.
If this is a Twinkie, then imagine a Twinkie.
35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
First cookies, now Twinkies. Will the internet ever be good for us? For Studio 360, I'm Derek John.
At Studio360.org, you can listen to any one of dozens of segments from our Science and Creativity series. And if you don't mind, let our cookies alone so that we can remember who you are when you visit. Now, we've been talking a lot today about the high-tech ways that we watch each other. Smartphone, social media, satellites. What about the low-tech ways, like sitting in your car in the dark and staring a little too long into a stranger's kitchen window? Michelle Everson has turned Peeping Tom moments into a provocative series of photographs.
I remember one night, I drive up to this one house, and I had my camera on my seat, strapped in, focused on a particular window, and I was sitting in front of it, and I must have been there, you know, a while, maybe a half hour. I watched for a long time, and I was fixing my camera and checking everything, and all of a sudden, a tap on my window. I jumped. There was a gentleman, and he said, "Why are you photographing me in my house?" And so I did say to him in a loud voice, I said, "I'm a photographer, and I'm photographing people in their homes at night." And I just started my car and drove away. My name is Michelle Everson. I began this photographic series in 1995. The name of the series is Night Surveillance Series. And what I am doing is photographing people at night in their homes. And I use the camera to create these intimate type of discoveries. I'll look at one of the photographs and talk to you about it. Untitled number 88 is two people in the image, and it was the oddest thing. They were interacting, but his back was to her, and her face was to his back. They weren't talking, but they kept moving, and I was very curious as to what was going on. And finally, he had stepped back slightly into an area where I could see him, and she was popping his pimples. There was another image that I was looking in on a neighbor, and she was binging, eating potato chips. Potato chip after potato chip was going into her mouth. They're like these beautiful tableaus to me. They tell a story. They show people's lives. I kind of find my theater, you know, the actual window. And then the performance begins. This is what happens. All of a sudden, I get very excited. It's like, oh, my God, this is what they're doing. I've got to get this, you know. And then I shoot it, and I take off as fast as I can because I want to get out of there. I just want to leave because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for me to be watching them. They're black and white images, approximately 40 by 48 inches in size. I need to have these images be approximate size of the windows and make you as uncomfortable as I am when you're looking at them because you become complicit in looking at them. I watched her for a while. She was in her kitchen. I loved the shape of the shade. And she finally turned around and came straight for the front of the window. And then she picked up this plate. It was a small, like a dessert plate. It was almost in slow motion for me as she put it up to her face and began to lick the plate. And when I go home after I finish shooting, I'm like, shut the doors, shut the windows, close everything. You know, because I know who I am, and I know what I'm doing, but I don't know who's out there watching me. And when I know that they're going to be seen in a gallery or on the internet or wherever they're going to be, I feel like that this is an exposure that excites me. You know? I think about it all the time, like, what if the shoe were on the other foot? If someone else were doing this to me, would I be mad? Yes. Would I feel upset? Probably. Was it my own fault? Yes. Did I have my window open? Yes. That's how I look at it. And I don't know exactly when I'm going to put it to rest. It could be tomorrow. But I've been watching someone's house lately that I think I really do want to make a photograph of.
Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. We've got a slideshow of some of Michelle Everson's photos at studio360.org. Take a look and tell us what you think. Is it okay to violate somebody's privacy in the name of art? Is what she does cool or creepy or very creepy? We want your comments at studio360.org. Last week on the show, I threw out the question, do you reread books and rewatch movies a lot, or is once or twice enough? For me, I feel like there are so many great books, new and classics, that I haven't read yet that I just can't afford to keep rereading. But 2/3 of you said, uh-uh, you love revisiting the characters and stories in your favorite books and movies over and over again. Jim from Charlotte, Vermont called it comfort food. If you can convince me that I'm wrong about a particular book, I'll call you up and you can try to persuade me. In either case, drop us a note at studio360.org.
I'm Amy Bender. I'm a fiction writer and I teach creative writing at USC.
Amy wanted to write a story for us about the Big Bang. But before she wrote it, we asked her to do a little research. So we introduced her to Nick Warner. He teaches physics, astronomy, and math, also at USC, as it happens.
And I do research into string theory, and particularly black holes and what string theory has to say about black holes.
So the scientist explained to the fiction writer about the universe expanding the moments after it was created.
Before the expansion was nothing?
Well, it's an impossible question because the notion of before is dependent on having a universe in which to measure time. And if you don't have a universe in which to measure time, you can't talk about before or after.
Amy Bender figured out a way. Here's her story, written especially for us.
We met the new teacher for origin class. He was tall, with a mustache. He was our last resort. The family genealogy class had failed. The trip to the zoo to look at monkeys had failed. The investigation of sperm and egg in a dish had failed. All were interesting, but they were not enough. Where did the sperm come from? Where did the monkey come from? Where did Romania come from? He sat in a chair at the front of the rug. We began all at once, everywhere, he said. We sat quietly, waiting. Has he started? Someone whispered. Yes, he said, I have started. We began all at once, everywhere. We thought about that. But before that, he shrugged. Goes beyond what we know, he said. All we can know is the universe. I thought we started in a dot, someone said. He shook his head. He brought out his lunch. No dot, he said. A dot is at a point. And if at a point, things are also not at that point. We watched as he chewed a baby carrot. A very well-packed dot, someone else offered, from which all things hurled free, not unlike a suitcase. Nope, he said. Everywhere, all at once. Then what? Someone asked. After that, he said, well, at first, it was fast. Everything accelerating fast. Everything wanting to get out. Get out of what? Poor wording, he said. Just rapid acceleration. Then it slowed down. Now expansion is accelerating steadily. What expansion? Oh, the universe is expanding, he said, wiping his mouth. We found that out in 1929, from Hubble. We nodded. This made sense. It had been in a suitcase, and then no suitcase, he said, stomping his foot. All at once, everywhere. Someone started to cry. Someone else pushed someone else into the rug. How about this, he said. He put away his lunch bag and opened his briefcase and brought out puppets to show us personified matter and radiation. So, he said, what happened was that around 400,000 years, everything slowed and cooled, and matter grew lumpy due to gravity, and radiation stayed smooth. Before that, the two lived evenly together. He had two socks wound together, and then they moved away from each other, and the lumpy sock got all lumpified, ready to form galaxies, and the smooth sock that had swallowed a light bulb radiated. Nice, we said. The origin of galaxies, he said. Won't the light bulb burn the sock? No, he said. It's a specially insulated sock. Are we accelerating right now? Yes, he said. Edgar grabbed onto his seat. I feel it, he shouted. He fell off his chair. The teacher removed the socks from his hands. We can't feel it, he said. But everything is moving away from everything else. And it does mean that in a few billion years, even our beautiful neighbors may be drifting out of reach. He looked sad, saying that. We felt a sadness. In a billion years, our beautiful neighbors pulling away. But surely we will not be here in a billion years. Surely we will be something new, something that might not conceive of distance in the same way. We told him this, and he nodded, but it was wistful. He set up a telescope on a corner of the roof, and we went to take a look. This is time travel, he said, squinting an eye to set the lens. Because the light is old. We're seeing back in time. No, we said, wrinkling our noses. We are seeing right now, today. No, he said, the light has to travel to us, and it takes millions of years. What you're seeing is time. Excuse me, we said. We were embarrassed to correct him. He seemed so smart. What we're seeing is space. It's space, yes, he said. It's also time. You're seeing what has already happened. That's ridiculous, we said, though we did not move. We make bigger telescopes, radio telescopes, he said, to see back all the way. We can go back 13 billion years, almost to the Big Bang. No, we said. Yes. You can see all that way back? Yes. And, we said, sitting up, the suitcase? We pictured it at the end of a telescope, the longest, biggest telescope ever made, a tiny suitcase of a pleasing brown leather. Well, he said, leaning on the side wall, we can see very close to the beginning, but at around 400,000 years, the universe goes opaque. We almost threw him off the roof then. It's true, he said. We can see all the way to about year 400,000, but before that, it's veiled. We consider this. The universe began in a veil. Like a bride, we said. He smiled, for the first time that day. Sure, he said, relenting. Like a bride. And she takes off her veil at 400,000. She does, he said. We see her quite well after that. So, who'd she marry? We ask, settling ourselves at his feet. When a bride removes her veil, it's the moment of marriage. I don't know, he said. Everything? Us?
Origin Lessons by Amy Bender. It was read by Kevin Pariseau. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi,
Rachel Greenberg.
Thanks this week to Chloe Plant, Ave Carrillo, our pals at On the Media, and as always, WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the most famous Icelander on Earth gives us a glimpse of the future with her new interactive album, Biophilia.
I tried to approach it from as different angles as possible, with the subject matter of being where music and nature meet.
The one and only Björk. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.